welcome to the 225th episode of Radio Free Nintendo, the first episode of 2011. Joining me for this special occasion is Mr. John Lindemann.
Hello, pleased to be here.
James Jones.
Doesn't feel all that special.
Joining us from the city so nice, they named it twice, Jonathan Metz.
Hello.
Do you feel different being in the big city?
I feel tired. And I'm a little sick, and I'm recording on different computers than normal. So, yeah, that's why Greg's hosting.
Yes, exactly. It's a little bit different, but it's basically going to be the same usual formula of RFM. We're going to start off with new business and then catch up with your listener mail in the second segment. And so let's get underway with new business. And Johnny, you're going to lead us off.
Well, first off, Happy New Year, everyone. This is our first show of 2011. First of many, I hope. Glad to be with you guys for yet another year of Radio Free Nintendo. I've been traveling a lot over the holidays, obviously, and so I haven't played a whole lot of new stuff. I haven't had access to my gaming consoles for a couple of weeks. I have continued playing The World Ends With You, and I'm actually, I think I'm caught up with where Greg was last week, roughly.
Right.
And so I anticipate that I will actually finish that pretty soon. I've gotten this far. I might as well finish it off. And I would agree with most of what he and James said about those sort of late game stuff last time. So it does get better. I think I was kind of right in the midst of the doldrums of week two with the really long chapters. And
yes.
So it did pick up the pace once I pushed on through that, and I'm glad I did. The only game that I've been playing recently that I haven't talked about before is a computer game. I've been playing a lot of stuff on my netbook since I've been traveling, and that includes a lot more Reseteer. It's everything James said it would. I like it quite a bit. You know, I picked it up for a buck with a Steam deal, and I've enjoyed it quite a bit. It runs a little iffy on my netbook, but it's good enough to play.
Yeah, I never got the feeling it was designed and tuned for maximum efficiency.
No, and there's an element of randomness with people coming into the shop that annoys me, because these adventurers that Reseteer takes out when you go play the action part of the game, the Zelda-like part, they have their own equipment, and you can sell them equipment that will improve their stats. The problem is they can only upgrade their equipment if they randomly come into your store and buy something that's on display. You can give them equipment temporarily when you take them out, but you can't give them or even sell them equipment as needed. Here, take this knife. It's better than that piece of shit you've been carrying.
Why are you beating these guys with a rock? Just take this.
I keep buying nice equipment and putting it on display and praying that these adventurer characters will come into the store and buy it and upgrade, and they don't. And it's I mean, they do occasionally, but they don't very often, and it's annoying.
Or invariably somebody comes in who's not one of them and tries to buy it, and you're
right.
Like, ugh.
And they're willing to take it for a very high profit margin, and so I sell it to them, and then my character comes in wanting a weapon, and I just sold it to this other person. So I could do without that. It's not that I don't want the randomness of the characters coming in the store. I just would like an extra feature where I can just do a one-to-one sale. Here, you should take this. I'll sell it to you at a loss. Just take it.
Please.
But no, the game I haven't talked about before that I really want to is called VVVVVV. And it's a game that I downloaded the demo from Steam months ago. I don't know why. I just maybe was looking for demos and saw this one and figured I'd pick it up. And then I didn't play it for a long time. And then recently I finally was like, okay, I want to play this. What the hell is this thing? I really didn't know anything about it. And I popped in the demo, and it's amazing. It's a faux retro sort of 8-bit platformer. So you're going to hear a lot of comparisons to Super Meat Boy, because it seems a similar kind of concept, but it's done a very different way. It's strictly 8-bit. It looks like a Commodore 64 or an early NES game with big, bright, garish colors and, you know, no textures at all, a lot of solid color backgrounds and things like that, very blocky, choppy-looking character sprites. And the graphics are very simple. The soundtrack is amazing. It is strictly 8-bit. It's done by a guy who's apparently known as an 8-bit composer. And it sounds fantastic. I really, really love the music in this. And the gameplay is really interesting, because it's kind of a continuous world. So you can explore it like a Metroid game. And yet you go into these sections that are set up they're kind of separate and they're set up more like levels. So right. There's an overworld that you can explore. You can tackle the levels in any order, kind of like maybe Zelda, the original Legend of Zelda. You know, you can do the dungeons in almost any order you want to. It's just, you know, go out and find one. But once you get in the dungeon, it feels self-contained and fairly linear. And the game is basically a 2D platformer, but you can't jump. So instead, you change the direction of gravity, up or down. And right. That's it. The only buttons in the game are left, right, and action. And action flips gravity. So it's a 3-button game. You can play it on your keyboard. And I think that's a big difference between
V to the 6.
V6. Let's call it that, V6. I think the main difference is that V6 is more of a puzzle game. It's more of a platformer puzzle game in that you get to a screen and you know there's no items, there's no special powers or anything like that. You've got everything you need to get through this room, and yet it's not always evident how you would do that. And so it pays to kind of to look at the room and think about it for a bit, or to try a few different things. And it's much less reflex-oriented than Super Meat Boy. Certainly, you need good reflexes, and there are rooms in the game that are pretty infuriating because they require very, very meticulous tapping of the keypad in order to get, you know, to land on a small platform or to time it exactly correctly so that you move at exactly the right amount. But overall, it is much less demanding of your, you know, hand-eye coordination than Super Meat Boy, and I was able to beat the entire game on my netbook keyboard.
Nice.
So you don't need a controller to play it on the computer. It would probably help a little bit, but you don't need it. Whereas I can't imagine playing Super Meat Boy on a keyboard. I really can't.
Yeah. It requires too much finesse.
Yeah, and V6 is it's just a little more cerebral, you know? It's sure. Extremely clever. The design of the rooms and the platforming challenges is so clever that my only real complaint about the game is I just wish there was more of it. I mean, I bought it for $250. I think the standard price is $5. And if you like these old 8-bit platformers, I think you will absolutely adore this game. It is hard, but it's not unfair, and it's certainly not as evil as Super Meat Boy. I'd put it more in the Donkey Kong Country Returns tier of difficulty. The nice thing is that there are so many save points in the game, and you just walk over them and they're activated. And then after that, if you die, you respawn from that point immediately. So it's very, very fast-paced. You almost never have to replay more than 1 or 2 seconds if you die. And so it encourages you to just keep trying and never give up. Yeah, and experiment. Yeah, exactly. The game is mechanically very simple, but I think the guy who made this game designed it in such a way that he extracts virtually everything you can imagine out of these very simple gameplay mechanics. And the level designs are they're so good. That just the simple act of traversing. I mean, if you think about it, you've got a floor and there's some spikes in the middle and you need to get over them. If you can't jump, that becomes now a really interesting challenge. How do you get over that? Well, it depends on what's above you because you're flipping gravity. And so if there's spikes up there too, then now you have to maneuver in midair as you flip gravity in order to negotiate through this thing. And that's the simplest challenge in this game. So even though the mechanics are very simple and the controls are very simple, the game itself is complex and always very interesting. I think it's fantastic.
I mean, that kind of reminds me, sounds a bit like as a reduced form version of And Yet It Moves in a way, a similarity there. Although obviously with And Yet It Moves, you're sort of tilting the whole world rather than sort of just flipping gravity. But
well, V6 feels a lot cleaner than that.
Yeah, it seems a bit sort of streamlined, very down to the basics and more about the level design.
Yeah, it's easier to understand intuitively because it's simpler. And because of that, the designer is able to make the game more challenging and more intricate.
I think I've heard also of an Irem 8-bit game that has similar mechanics. Is it Metal Storm or something like that? I've heard about it before.
Yeah, there's a game like that. There's also, I think there's Super Low G-Man or something like that. I mean, the idea of flipping gravity has been around for a long time. And a lot of platformers will put, I mean, even, you know, in Mario Galaxy 2, there are levels like this where you flip gravity. But you generally don't flip it on command like you do in V6.
Yeah.
And plus, that's always, it's a small segment of other platformers. There are Mega Man levels like that. But this game, it's the entire game is set up that way. And it's so interesting to see how much they get out of it and how interesting the challenges can be. So I do very, very highly recommend it. It's cheap as hell on Steam. The standard price is $5. You might even get it for less like I did. Really, try the demo. You got nothing to lose. And I think the game is spectacular.
Sounds pretty cool to me. Well, thanks for that, Johnny. Now you're going to have to duck out of the show for a little while. But never fear, yep. Johnny will be back in Listener Mail.
It's a mystery.
And we now move on for the rest of your business. So, James, what have you got for new business this week?
So I went and pulled another game off of the pile.
Getting smaller.
Lindemann Syndrome in full effect for James Jones.
It's not Lindemann Syndrome, though, because I actually play them.
If it is, it's in remission.
Define play.
Yes.
Mine's 5 minutes. Done. Played. I consider it played. Unwrapped, put in 5 minutes,
job done.
Job done, on to the next one.
I complete them.
It does.
But this game was a DS title I just picked up just because I saw it at a store cheap, which was Touch Detective, which is kind of an old DS game now.
Right.
But I happened across it for like $5. I'm like, well, that's about as cheap as a DS game gets.
Yeah, I think you would be literally penny-pinching if you're wanting it to be lower than that.
Gosh, can I get this a little bit cheaper? It was $5 plus the GameStop discount of 10%, which takes a whole total 50 cents off of it. I'm like, I've just bought myself most of a soda from a vending machine. So if you don't know about Touch Detective, or you don't remember, because like I said, it's old. It's an adventure game starring what is essentially a young girl in a completely screwed up world where she's playing a detective and she's trying to solve cases.
It's so immediately reminding me a little bit of the aforementioned Recetteer in terms of your girl screwed up world.
Yeah, a little bit. This world's a little bit more modern than the Recetteer world. But yeah, basically Mackenzie, the main character, lives in this town where mysterious things happen that aren't very sane. In one case, a friend of hers who is completely psychotic asks her to investigate if her dreams are being stolen.
Well, it seems easy enough to verify. Yeah,
that's the first case. Are my dreams being stolen?
It's just another day at the office.
So without spoiling what happens, the answer is actually yes, because that's the kind of world we live in this game.
Well, it would be disappointing to have that possibility raised and then find, well, of course not, you can't steal dreams.
No,
silly.
Of course
that's not much of a game.
But
this is the big I win button. No.
Just use the touchscreen to slap her and say that's a preposterous idea.
But it's not enough that you think this is a stupid idea, because Mackenzie, who is the least insane person in this game by about a mile, will note to herself, well, that doesn't make any sense. Because half the game is her talking to people, and on the top screen, as she's having these conversations, her own personal thoughts about what's going on will pop up, and most of them are her going, I don't understand what they're talking about. What's wrong with these people? And it's not enough that you've been hired to investigate whether or not this girl's dream has been stolen, but your friend slash detective rival has also decided to interrupt this case and investigate it herself, and she is perfectly convinced that this is a rational case that she should take, and she's going to steal from you. And I'll spoil a little bit of it, because it's good to give you the kind of feel for the nature of this game. Mackenzie lives in her office with her butler, whom builds her a device using a pillow, a scent of flowers to help you feel tired, and another item, I can't remember what it was, something equally stupid, that lets you basically go into someone else's dreams. Now, her butler is either a robot or a 300-year-old vampire, which I can justify by the fact that in his workshop there is a sarcophagus, and if you click it, Mackenzie notes to herself that that is his bed. Also, he's blue.
FYI.
It's, as an adventure game, the game kind of struggles because a lot of times what you have to do is a bit obtuse. So there's one case where you're investigating the same friend of yours who's completely insane and is the source of almost all of the cases, comes by to tell you that there's been a murder at the circus. Not that she saw a murder, but she saw a shadow of a murder.
It's just shadow puppetry murder.
Yes, it was a shadow puppetry murder. What she actually saw was a flea circus being reflected on a spotlight that had fallen into the flea circus's area. So a flea was murdered.
But he was murdered.
That's a new one on me.
Yeah.
Is this game very Jurassic Park now?
Yeah.
Can I see the fleas, mommy?
But at one point, you have to secure the crime scene of the fleas. But they don't quite tell you it that way. So what you have to do is you have to use this police tape you found earlier and use it on the fleas' house to tie it down. Now, there's no reason why you would think to try this, but I basically had a limited number of inventory items and just started poking them on everything.
Not big on lateral thinking.
There is some seriously kind of confusing puzzles in this game.
So, I mean, generally solving these cases, I assume obviously using the touchscreen interface is
right.
You're just trying different items that you've got until something kind of works.
Sometimes. I mean, some cases it's pretty reasonable what you're trying to do. When Mackenzie's not busy solving cases, she's stealing mail from people's postal boxes. And when you examine the item to open it, you see the letter, oh, this is a threat against the circus. I should probably go show this to the circus master. Mind you, he's not particularly concerned about the fact you're reading his mail, but he does recognize that this is a letter to him, and it does give you some story objective. You know, it's compact for an adventure game. I breezed through it, you know, maybe 10 or so hours.
Right.
There's no timer, so I'm not exactly sure. But it's mostly the game's qualities come from the fact that it's really funny and its weirdness is actually humorous in context versus just being alarming and without context. But when events happen like the less than sane friend goes missing and your detective rival decides the best course of action to investigate this is break the window into her room and completely ransack the place, not looking for anything in particular, just because that seems like what she should do. You grow to accept these kinds of logical thoughts from the people, and they're just like, all right, that's funny. It's no longer alarming that someone would suggest this in a game starring girls in their teens living in a dormitory.
Well, suppose the brass tacks question is, worth $4.50?
Well, I bought lunch that day for $6. I'd say it was about comparable to the lunch, but it's maybe not quite comparable to a better lunch I could have bought for $10.
Well, that's about as much as a Starbucks coffee, right? So the question is, Starbucks or Touch Detective?
Oh, Touch Detective, definitely.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that'll stand for someone in good stead when they've posed with a similar dilemma.
to put it this way, if I see the sequel, I will shell out at least $10 for it. Assuming they're trying to sell it to me for $4, at which point I'd be like, I'll give you $3.50 with this discount card.
All right, well, we'll then move on. John, have you got anything? It's been the holidays, obviously, so none of us are overflowing with new games to play, but have you managed to crack open anything?
Nothing new. I did play some Dragon Quest IX, which is, of course, highly enjoyable.
You must be getting close to Johnny's hour count now, right?
How far is Johnny through it?
Like 100 hours.
Yeah, he's 100 and something. Yeah, I'm probably about, I would say probably about 90 hours away from that. But I'm gaining. I think I'm probably gaining on him at this point, though. The other game I played a little while back was for PSP, one that I kind of picked up off of my very small backlog pile, Resistance Retribution, which is kind of one that I sort of picked up. I got it for some crazy cheap price, as I do with all of my PSP games.
I seem to remember you discussing this.
Yeah, this was one where I played it for a little bit, and I decided to go back to it because it is actually, I mean, in terms of, you know, graphics and all that, it's actually really, really well done. The engine, I think it's done by the same team. I think it's the Sony's Bend Studio. I think they do the PSP SOCOM games. It's really, really well done. The engine is really good, but the writing is atrocious. It is.
Give us some examples, John.
Well, no, and the reason why it's so bad is not because, I mean, the actual writing is okay, but it is the most bro-y game I've ever played. I mean, it trumps Gears of War.
Oh, no.
Killzone.
You've played a few, haven't you? So this is no small distinction.
Yeah.
This is a new level of bro-iness.
It's the thing is, and I guess I think really why it's so impactful in this sense is because.
Impactful bro-iness?
It's completely, I mean, it's just not needed whatsoever in this game.
So give us some bro-iness samples.
Well, okay, so, you know, it's set in, I think, 1951, you know, in this alternate universe, sort of alternate history kind of thing where.
Wait, that didn't really happen?
Yeah, maybe near world. But in the world that the rest of us live in, this didn't actually happen. So if James, I don't want you to get scared. I don't want any War of the Worlds episode here. But, you know, the aliens have invaded and, you know, they've taken over, but they're fighting aliens, but they're using kind of like World War II tanks and stuff like that, which really, you know, and of course they've taken some of the alien tech and crafted their own guns and et cetera. But yeah, so you're playing, James Grayson, who is kind of this badass mercenary sort of guy whose brother died and he's been hellbent to kill the aliens ever since. I mean, there's lots of cutscenes in it. Like, they're very small, so they're pretty well done. They don't really, it never turns into a Metal Gear Solid 4 kind of cutscene fest. But, generally, like, whenever you come into a new area, which is quite frequently, you know, there'll be a little cutscene and James will have some choice, words for the aliens.
So wait a minute. He's this kind of smack talk or whatever is directed at the aliens.
Yes, and you know I think the pinnacle of it, and where I just kind of said this has to end, is where you're in this mech. You hop into this pretty cool part where, because they kind of mix it up between sort of the third person shooting and you can hop into vehicles. And so you hop into this mech, and he's just about to, you know, light these aliens up, and he's like, "It's James Grayson, bitches." Bear in mind, this is set in 1951. That's what makes it a complete howler. And that was where I was just like, okay, that's where I just put the game down.
All right, so does James Grayson appear that he has used many, many forms of steroids in the past?
No, actually, he is...
I don't think they had human growth hormone in alternate 1951.
Yeah, no, this is 1951, so there's no steroided out people in this game.
His neck isn't the size of a tree.
But it's just, what amazes me, though, is like the amount, now, there's no F-bombs, maybe there's a couple, but there's like S-bombs all over the place. You know,
S-bombs.
I don't give a shit, I'm gonna kill all of these aliens, rah! I mean, it's unbelievable.
Ouch.
It's just completely unnecessary.
That is a problem. You get this with certain cable TV shows as well, where there's like the one swear word that they're allowed to use. Mm-hmm. And so it gets really overused because, you know, if it were real, people would actually have alternate four-letter words that they could use.
Yeah. Yep.
Sorry, guys. I'm stuck with shit.
Yeah. It's so funny because even when compared to the rest of the actual series, like the PS3 series.
Yeah.
It's just so completely out of character, because the PS3 series is actually, like, you know, has a fairly serious storyline. There's no goofy characters. There's no Killzone 2 crazy black guy swearing all the time. There's nothing like that. I mean, the series isn't like that. And this is, it's like they hired, like, the writers of Maxim magazine to write the script. And it's just really, really weird. But, so aside from that, not too much, but, you know, it's always nice to kind of get on the road and play some portable games for a while, because typically when I'm at home, I really don't, it just seems kind of weird to be playing them.
Well, I'm going to wrap up new business now. I've decided that, having pretty much been done for the time being, at least with Donkey Kong Country Returns, I'd finally get around to picking up Donkey Kong Country 3 for the Virtual Console. I've never played it before. I've got the second one on Virtual, which was one of like my first Virtual Console purchases that I had at all. But the third one's been out for like 3 years now, I think, or something. I think it was like in Europe anyway, it was like a Christmas update back in 2007. But I've only just got around to it now, mainly because, you know, it was never meant to be all that different from the other Donkey Kong Country games. It's worth keeping in mind that they came out year on year from 94 to 96. So there wasn't a whole lot of time for them to develop and diversify, if you like. And of course, that meant that this came out at a time after the N64 had launched in Japan and America anyway, which is actually kind of referenced in the game. Like, when you go and save at one of these wrinkly Kong caves, on occasions you'll actually be playing an N64 and it's got like a slightly messed with version of the Mario 64 castle theme playing in the background. Hmm. So I don't know whether that was like a sort of passive aggressive gesture that their game was getting massively overshadowed at that point by the 3D stuff on the N64. But playing it now, I was kind of, in some ways, kind of pleasantly surprised by it. And then on the other hand, it kind of reinforced some of the things things that, you know, I never particularly loved about the DKC games on the Super NES. I mean, I played quite a lot of the first one a few months ago, just kind of revisiting that. And I mean, it's unquestionably a more sophisticated game than the first ones, you know, in the boss design, in some of the way that, like, their secret stuff is hidden. You know, like, for instance, on each level, you have to kill a special enemy that has a shield with a metal barrel to get a DK coin. And that could sometimes have, you know, some nice little puzzles associated with that. You wouldn't have found anything quite like that in the original DKC. That was very straightforward. How much more advanced it is than the second one, I'm kind of struggling to remember at this point, because I played the second one like 3.5 years ago now or something. And that definitely did make some very significant improvements on the first DKC game. But with this, much like Returns for the Wii, there's a lot of levels where you're being kind of driven forward by various things. Like, you might be like climbing up a rope that's on fire, so you're constantly having to move. Or like, there's a level where you play as one of the animal friends, this elephant that's just been scared by rats, so it's constantly running, and it's pretty much like a minecart level, except you're an elephant. But the problem, this much bigger problem on the Super NES, and I find it a real kind of issue, because that graphic style, you know, the sprites are pretty chunky and everything, and it does feel like kind of claustrophobic now, you know, because you're really not seeing that much of the game world outside of your characters. And when you're moving at high speed and you've got to react to stuff, I mean, you've got very little time or capacity to anticipate the hazards. I mean, you've got to see it at the edge of the screen and react very quickly. And so I would say, yeah, because it isn't as intricate and imaginative as something like Donkey Kong Country Returns, it's not as challenging, but it is more frustrating, because just sometimes where it's like, well, you know, how am I going to see what to do there when, you know, I can barely see that far in front of my face? And what they really have to do to kind of try and make up for that is have the, you know, the bananas. Like, the bananas are left in trails on the screen. And at times, I mean, it is almost like they're trying to choreograph every move for you with the bananas. Like, you know, it's okay, well, hold on to the right side of the rope now and then back to the left side, because I don't think you could really anticipate it any other way. I mean, they do that in Donkey Kong Country Returns to some extent, but you don't need it so much because, you know, for instance, the camera's dynamic. So, like, when you get that scene with the ant swarm, it zooms out. So you've got this really quite, you know, with the widescreen as well, you've got this panorama. You can see all the stuff that's in front of DK, so you can know how to get through it quick enough to avoid being swarmed by the ants. Whereas here, you know, you're pretty much just relying on those banana trails, and that's not, you know, uniformly effective, if you like. So they clearly understood the nature of the problem, you know, and they put something in there to address it, but it's not, you know, it's not all that it could be in that regard. The other thing that strikes me about it is just that the character designs are wretched. They're so bad. I mean, I was never a big fan of, like, a lot of the Donkey Kong Country designs. Like, I shed no tears for the loss of the Kremlings in Donkey Kong Country Returns, because I think they're just stupid, bland characters. And so, do we really need another green lizard guy as the villain? Like, we had Bowser, we had Wart in Mario. Like, it's pretty much the least imaginative platform villain you can possibly conceive of. But here, they're obviously much the same, but just somehow worse, because I guess they felt they had to, you know, redesign enemies so that it felt like a new game, but they were churning them out so fast, they're just really terrible. I mean, you play as Kiddie Kong, the sort of giant baby, and he is, you're pushing it for the nadir of all platform character designs. I mean, it's just, well, it's like, why? Why can't I just play as Donkey Kong?
Yeah.
His name is in the title.
It's so strange that they felt the need to, like, have this sort of weird progression of, like, okay, so in the second game, you're played to rescue Donkey Kong, and then in the third game, we get rid of Diddy as well, because you're played to rescue both of them. It's just like, the story's not really that important.
If,
just,
if, yeah. If he's so ineffectual as to need to be rescued constantly, maybe just let him keep him.
You know, it's like, why have we got to go sort of further and further down the totem pole until we get to, we've got Diddy in a blonde wig for Dixie Kong, and we've got Donkey Kong in a giant baby suit. It's just so dumb.
Yeah, you'd think that if they were still making the game, we'd probably be up to about 100 types of Kongs by now.
I would have enjoyed greatly if it really was Diddy in a blonde wig.
From a story point of view, could have been amusing, but some people kind of regard maybe, you know, some of the later stuff like maybe DK64 or Banjo-Tooie as like the sort of low point of Rare character designs with just like sticking eyes on stuff. But I kind of think they hit it a lot earlier, actually.
Well, I mean, Conker is the king of sticking eyes on stuff.
Yeah, with Conker, though, it's kind of...
It's become a bit self-referential.
It's an in-joke.
Because they're like, yes, we just put eyes on a paint can and a hay bale.
A bale of hay, yeah.
It's like, really? These are my enemies I have to fight in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... Well, they certainly had previous on it. But, I mean, you know, the game, other than that, the graphics, I don't think there's something of a noticeable kind of step up from the first one, at least, you know, in terms of... Certainly the use of the background layers like parallax and stuff, it seems more pronounced and more impressive, like in the forest areas or the sort of coral reef underwater stages are very feel a bit more dense than the ones in the first one. But the game, the issues with the visibility and the anticipation aside, I mean, there is a lot of stuff to find. There's like a very interesting kind of element to it where you have to actually explore the overworld map kind of freely, and you get upgrades to this vehicle that you use to traverse the overworld map, which is how you unlock some of the later worlds. Like, so you'll start off on like a sort of basic kind of raft, and then you work your way up to like a hovercraft and stuff that can get to different parts of the map and then open up other new worlds. And then there's like a final secret world. I guess I've done the first ending, if you like, but there's another secret world that you unlock, and that to get to those levels you need to have collected these bonus coins, which are very much like the jigsaw pieces in Returns, the ones that you get from the bonus barrels, you know, where you sort of warp to the bonus stage and you have to collect a certain number of bananas.
Right.
It's that, yeah, you've got stuff that's almost exactly like that for these coins in three, that each level in the progression in this final secret world needs like 15 of those coins to unlock them. And then I think there's like a final secret ending at the end of that world. So it's definitely got more to it, than the original DKC. And I've enjoyed it to a pretty good extent, actually, but it's still got some of those same kind of limitations that you had with the original. The other weird thing with it, actually, is that this soundtrack wise is not as kind of catchy as 1 and 2. I mean, it's still quite atmospheric and the instrument quality is good, but it's definitely not as memorable. But the weird thing about that was it was only kind of partially done by the guy that did the original DKC and the sequel soundtracks. But when they did it for GBA, that guy, David Wise, I think his name is, came back and actually did the soundtrack from scratch for right. the re-release. So it was a whole new soundtrack, pretty much.
Yes.
That replaced the one that's in the Super NES game and therefore the Virtual Console release, which I think is really weird. I don't think I've ever heard of that, like the original composer coming back and redoing a soundtrack. That's very odd, but I don't know how the two compare, but you can kind of tell a difference between this one and the previous ones. So I can see how that happened. All right, well, that is going to do it for New Business. When we come back, Johnny will return and we'll be answering your questions in listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, on the feature front, we have an interesting article compiled by Carly, Nintendo World Report's top 20 articles of 2010. What were our most popular articles of the year? Carly tallies up the hits and brings you the first batch of our most read articles of the year. Are there any surprises? Make sure to check it out and see.
Yes, it's short.
Yes,
surprises.
Second half, things go to hell.
In terms of reviews, we have a review of Star Wars The Force Unleashed 2 for the Nintendo DS. Nathan looks at it and poses the question, is the Force strong with this handheld beat-em-up?
Oh, really?
He weighs in and...
That's the best you've got?
He weighs in and tells us how this version compares to the console edition.
Ugh. Pedro has a review of Beyblade Metal Fusion Battle Fortress. Yes, that is the real title. For Wii, which is a game about tops made of metal, apparently.
Dude, they're Beyblades, alright? Get it right.
Beyblades, excuse me. And he tells you if it's a game for fans of the series or for games in general, but they're not tops, apparently.
And rounding out this week's No Playing is Neil's review of Shaun White Skateboarding for the Wii, where we see Shaun White make the transition to skateboarding with a game that's more than a little inspired by The Blob. Neil tells us whether or not it's the best of both.
Both what? Skateboarding and The Blob?
It's an open-ended question. I left it purposely open-ended.
The best of existential reasoning and German philosophy.
Our listeners can fill in the blanks as appropriate.
Well, that is going to do it for Now Play this week, so be sure to check out all these articles and more at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the second part of the show. We're going to catch up now on your listener mail. And Johnny, you have the first letter.
All right, 120 in Surrey, British Columbia writes, first Super Meat Boy and now Retro City Rampage. Both were originally being developed exclusively for WiiWare until Microsoft recognized that both were excellent games that gamers would want to play, so they poached them. I have to give credit to Microsoft for actively seeking out these worthwhile gaming experiences and ensuring that they're available to 360 owners. However, I can't understand why Nintendo doesn't put forth a similar effort. When you see them publish a great game like Fluidity, you know the potential is there. Negotiating deals to keep games such as Super Meat Boy and Retro City Rampage exclusive, even for a short time, might be worth it just to get the hardcore who barely use their Wiis to drop a few bucks on the online shop. Without such interest, I fear there won't be any decent developers left who actually want to develop for the WiiWare service, and we all know that Nintendo already doesn't make it easy with file size limit, different business address, etc. What are your thoughts on this?
So, the issue of Super Meat Boy and Retro City Rampage, we know personally, are different. Super Meat Boy, the issue was Nintendo's file size limit that we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I don't understand really the publishing deal, because Microsoft, I don't think they published that on Xbox, but they've said that because of their deal with Microsoft, they can't put it on PSN.
Well, so here I'll get to that when I get to Retro City Rampage, because we have understandings for both of these.
Okay.
Super Meat Boy, the reason it never came to Wii or won't come to Wii is because of that file size restriction. They basically can't get a game they feel comfortable releasing down to what Nintendo's maximum size for a game is.
It was curious, wasn't it? There was an interview recently where the people from Team Meat were saying basically they were complacent in a sense that they thought the file size of 40 megs would come down, that they wouldn't have to deal with it in the end, that it could be, you know, sort of like Symphony of the Night style with 360 back in the day.
Right.
It would just get bumped up if it had to, and then, you know, it came down to it and the immovable object won.
Yeah.
Well, and the indications that we've had are that that limit is immovable. I mean, it's a technical limit. Mm-hmm. It could possibly be circumvented by Nintendo, but it would probably require a pretty extensive firmware update. It might even be one of those things that's kind of written on the metal, you know, like their GameCube UI and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it's intrinsic to the way it uses RAM and stuff like that. Like, they just can't do anything with it.
It probably can't be increased, or if it can, it's so difficult that... forget it.
They're not going to take the trouble to do it.
They're not going to do it.
So that one isn't so much that Microsoft poached it. That was more they basically went into the arms of a waiting suitor.
Yeah, you can tell that Super Meat Boy ballooned in scope as they developed it. And they kept adding more and more and more and more stuff, and they're still adding more stuff to it.
Right, which they would have had difficulty doing in the Wii version too.
Yeah, and 2 years ago when they first announced it for WiiWare, I'm sure at that time, according to their design doc, they thought it could actually fit. And over time, the game got bigger, and they thought, well, it's not a big problem. We'll just ask them to give us a waiver. And then once they realized that that wasn't going to happen, I respect them for not wanting to put out a shitty version on WiiWare, which they could probably do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Microsoft will ink these deals. They're not the publisher. But to get on the service, there have been many indications in the past, Microsoft service, that you have to play ball with Microsoft. And a lot of times what they want out of these smaller developers versus larger publishers is they want some amount of exclusivity. Sometimes they want full exclusivity for their service. Sometimes they want timed exclusivity. And we've seen a lot of reports in the industry where this is law. You cannot get on the service unless you do this for us. And that's probably what happened with Super Meat Boy. They probably said, we will not grant you access to the service unless you give us timed exclusivity for X amount of months. And it seems to be that their time frame is almost always 6 months. There are a lot of games that have 6 month or 3 month exclusivity windows for the Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah, if it comes out in Summer of Arcade, it has to be at least 1 month, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with Super Meat Boy is Team Meat has said their game can't ever come out on PSN because of their deal with Microsoft.
Right, and that
which
may
is
be
strange
the case.
To me, considering that Microsoft didn't publish that game and mm-hmm. that they were still able to put it, supposedly, to put it on WiiWare. So I don't understand what about their deal would keep them from putting it on PSN and yet still allow WiiWare.
I guess because perhaps they were already committed to do a WiiWare version
right.
at the time of negotiations with Microsoft, would be
that's
my guess.
That's probably the case. So, because yeah. these negotiations take place, according to one article we read about a game that was going to be on the service and Microsoft wanted it, but Microsoft wouldn't accede to the request they not have to be exclusive. The negotiations seemed to go up right up until the launch window. So it could well have been that there was already an agreement in place saying, we'll grant you the ability to release it on WiiWare. And maybe Microsoft, knowing that they were going to have difficulty release it, was like, yeah, sure, you can try.
So tell us quickly about Retro City Rampage.
So we spoke with the developers of Retro City Rampage, and this isn't an issue where they wanted to not launch on Wii at the same time with Microsoft. Without going into too much what they said, basically, this was out of their control. The game will be out on Wii in, I can't remember the time frame.
Baseball.
Yeah, but it is coming out. This wasn't something they wanted, and they're not happy about it, and they tried really hard to get it out there at the same time.
But the crux of it comes down to, again, the fact that generally it seems the only time that you can get a simultaneous cross-platform release for a digital download thing involving Xbox Live Arcade is if it's something big like Mega Man 9 or like Sonic 4 or something with an established publisher and an established IP. You can sort of get that done.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's an indie game like Retro City Rampage, you can't really seem to get that sort of favorable treatment.
Yeah, they seem to be, at least in the email, pretty upset at what happened. So, I mean, I understand that this was, you know, when you're a small company like that, there's only so much you can do.
I think, yeah, a lot of these small companies are getting thrown around a lot by these big platform holders. And look, I think we have to give Nintendo some credit. They don't appear to be doing that. Other than the technical problems and the lack of marketing on WiiWare, they're not pushing these small developers around like Microsoft and Sony are. They're not really requiring exclusivity or anything like that. You know, it's a fairly open platform. I mean, 120 notes, you know, problems with, like, you have to have a different business address. That's just to get a Wii development kit. That's a business decision by Nintendo.
Right.
It's because they don't want literal homebrewers. They want people who are serious enough to have an office.
Yeah.
That is pretty much the only restriction, though. I mean, in terms of outside of technical limitations, that's pretty much it. If you can afford a $2,000 development kit and you have a different business address, you can make a game for WiiWare.
Talk about being between a rock and a hard place, though, for an indie, because they have to sit there and they either deal with Nintendo's technical snafus versus getting pushed around by Microsoft. So
and really sucks. What you know is probably going to be the determining factor is, you know, where the money is, and not from the point of view of, you know, money hats, but just the market, who's buying. And all the indications are that Xbox Live is so much more lucrative than either of the other platforms, really, that probably that's why developers are willing to be put through all these restrictions and things by Microsoft, because the market's just too rich to ignore.
Mm-hmm. It's because over half of their user base on Xbox is online and knows about that store.
Right.
And because of the Xbox Live service and the way they have advertising built into it, Microsoft can and does push arcade games,
oh, yeah,
to people, even if all you ever do is turn it on and play Madden, you will see ads for Xbox Live Arcade games, and you can't say that about either of the other two services,
right,
really.
On the dashboard, they push games. I mean, if you get on the Live Arcade service, you know you're going to at least get some promotion. If you get on, like, the Nintendo service, you're going to get a poorly written press release every Monday.
And then on PSN, you won't be able to find anything anyways, so... You'll just never see the ad.
If you talk to a lot of developers in terms of business development and you ask them, how's it been like working with Nintendo on WiiWare, most of them are really, really happy about it. They're very positive. They say, we love working with Nintendo. They're really easy to work with. They're friendly and helpful. But they're not going to throw money hats at you. And
no.
I do think that the restriction on having a different business address is going to go away and should go away in the next generation, even from Nintendo. Because the problem with that is it discourages, what's the word, distributed development. You know, when you have people living in different countries or just different places, and they're all sending code back and forth to each other, and they might even have multiple development kits, or maybe they're just working on the game on their computers, and then they're sending it to one guy to compile it on his development kit. A lot of great computer games are made that way. And I think it's very old-fashioned for Nintendo to assume that people who would develop games like that aren't being professional or aren't going to maintain the quality levels of other developers. I mean, what we do is that way. Our website is distributed development. And if Nintendo treated us as members of the press the same way they treat developers, we wouldn't have any access to Nintendo at all. And that would be foolish of them because we're a big site and we have been for 10 years. So I think it's very old-fashioned, and I think that requirement needs to go away. I understand the thinking behind it, but they need to progress beyond that.
I mean, as we've seen, Nintendo apparently have bigger plans for some of their online revenue generation strategies with 3DS and whatnot. And certainly I would expect, you know, things like the shop interface and the marketing and the messaging to improve, but I don't think their laissez-faire approach will change. I don't think we'll see them having like all these restrictions and demands like Xbox or picking winners with money hats or all that. I don't see changing, which, you know, has good and bad things. Like I said, a lot of developers probably appreciate that more kind of hands-off approach.
Oh, you hear plenty of complaints about Microsoft and, you know, all the approval processes and the lot checks and getting things ready, and you don't know exactly when it's going to be published. And sometimes I've heard a lot of stories of people turning in games and waiting weeks and weeks, maybe months, for it to ever get published on Xbox Live Arcade. Maybe that's improved over time, but it's because Microsoft has such an extensive system of checks that they go through, and Nintendo doesn't really. So, you know, it's in some cases easier to develop for it, but it depends on what you want. And I think these kind of restrictions affect smaller companies a lot more than they affect the bigger companies, because they don't have entire QA departments, etc. So we hear about these things more with the smaller games.
No, I mean, it would be nice, even if Nintendo are not going to get terribly activist, to see more things like fluidity in terms of actually finding an indie game and publishing it and giving it the backing to get on to something like WiiWare or its successors.
Absolutely.
I could see them doing more in that realm.
Fluidity is not exactly developed by a tiny company, though. I mean, it's developed by an established developer.
Yeah, who's made plenty of retail games in the past.
Yes, so it's not a huge company, but it's certainly not tiny.
Yeah, I don't know if Nintendo gave them money to help develop it and increase the level of quality. That a lot of times publishing deals can do that. I think in terms of awareness, in terms of, you know, that game getting more attention because it's published by Nintendo, I think they failed. Even though they did have that press event, they invited a few people to go out and play it. There aren't many people talking about Fluidity. I've been listening to a lot of my favorite podcasts, and they're doing their Game of the Year discussions, and it's not coming up, and it should. Mm-hmm. It's not even being mentioned. Even when they're talking about download games, it's not being mentioned. I know it just came out, but I think a lot of people missed it, including a lot of the influence makers, the hype makers. They missed that game. And
opinion leaders.
The fact that Nintendo published it doesn't appear to have done it a whole lot of favors in terms of awareness, and that's too bad.
Yeah, but the problem is with the WiiWare environment as it is, it's difficult to see what scope there is for it to do that, because people are just not in the habit of regularly seeing what's new on WiiWare. for various reasons that go back years at this point. That's always going to disadvantage, a relatively new release from getting traction in the public domain very quickly. All right, well, we will now move on to the second letter, and James, you have this one.
Caesar from Australia writes, "Living in Australia, we get the scraps that fall off Europe's table, who in turn get the scraps that fall off the US plate, who in their own turn get a fraction of the stuff that comes out in Japan. Other Australians and Europeans will know the pain of waiting months or even years for niche games to come out here and then paying up to double the price for the privilege. In this, the original DS's region-free status and the availability of online shops like PlayAsia have been positive boon, and I'm no longer beholden to NAL's obtuse release schedule. Thanks to this, roughly half of my games are imports, and I have gotten some really great experiences out of it I couldn't get locally, such as Oendon, and until recently, the original Ace and Turdy games, which took years to come out here. However, with the DSi, region locking has come to handhelds for the first time. In my mind, this means that the winds at Nintendo are blowing towards region locking the 3DS for retail releases, stopping the gravy train once and for all. This has caused me to strongly consider importing a 3DS from the US and thus never buying locally again. I know that I am in the tiniest of minorities in being concerned about this, as the bulk of gamers simply don't import or travel enough that it's an issue. I also know that Nintendo, having learned their lesson with the Wii and DS, have locked down the firmware more tightly than ever before, so I don't hold out much hope for a region-free workaround. What do you guys think of this issue? Is there much hope for the 3DS being region-free?"
Nope.
I don't think so.
I'm not sure they've confirmed it's region locked yet, but I think they might have.
It's with the whole issue of DSi and the sort of integration with like the local rating systems now for parental controls and stuff.
I think that's a big part of it, but piracy is
it's partly
piracy too. It's the fact that they might have different piracy issues in different regions, and so I think they want to have different versions of the firmware possible in each region. And that means that the firmware may not be compatible from one region to the next. So they avoid a lot of potential compatibility problems by just region locking it.
Yeah, there's no doubt the DS has been really hit hard by piracy, so it's surprise that they're going to be stepping up on all these sorts of issues much more proactively.
Well, the other advantage that it gives them in region locking with respect to piracy is that it means if dumps of games do get out there, they're not effective on all hardware.
Yeah.
It's not like they could dump the Japan version of the next Pokemon game and you'd be able to put it on whatever device to play it on your hardware.
Or at least it makes it a little harder.
Yeah, a little bit at least. And the 3DS itself is designed in such a way that it is supposed to be an alternative to piracy, or at least playing it on an emulator, because you won't be able to get the 3D effect on your computer. Now, that was the same thought they had with the Wii and its controller, but that got worked around. And the DS with its touchscreen, but again, that was worked around too. So,
obviously the issue with the Wii and DS is that there are the solutions for playing, pirated downloaded ROMs on the device itself, which I'm sure is going to be a big thing for Nintendo. They're really going to want to try and avoid that being possible.
And some early reports from publishers basically said they felt pretty impressed with the security enhancements Nintendo's made from the 3DS over its predecessor.
So, that indeed may make it considerably more difficult for the kind of region-free solutions that homebrew people have developed for the Wii to be sort of recreated on 3DS. So, that could be just a sort of spillover effect of all the enhanced security might be that they won't be able to do that.
So, I know when the DSi came out and they region locked it. I mean, they only region locked it for DSi only games.
DSi where?
No, they there are DSi only cartridges.
Yeah, they're very, very
I know, but that's like five things. I mean,
those are the ones they region locked it for. They're the DSi where is region locked because you can't get to the DSi where shop of another region.
Yes.
So in that case, though, what they did do is the security procedures they put out there for the DSi actually killed all those R4 and Ace cards that were out there that let you play those games on your DS. Yeah. It essentially killed all the ones that were currently in production because of the new security procedures. Now, that didn't stop them from making new ones.
But only if you use one on a DSi.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I imagine it's almost like a staging ground for 3DS. Right. You know what I mean? They're just getting ready because that's the point. They're going to have these kinds of restrictions from day one so that you can't just go back to the DS Lite and play to your heart's content.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that respect, they identified what was currently being used as a workaround and killed it. So the new workaround that they have for the DSi on the ones they had, I mean, you had to buy a new unit if you wanted to play it on a DSi, but it's a little bit more shady than the old one. It required a bit more work.
I mean, what I would say, I suppose, in terms of, obviously, you know, it's very much in Nintendo's interest to put these sorts of things in, but, you know, the homebrew people, certainly, there's plenty of ingenious people working there. I mean, and there will be a great deal more motivation for the software-based workarounds, for instance, to be created when you get to 3DS, because, as Johnny said, you know, the DSi is this tiny sliver of retail games that it affects, and you can always just go back to DS Lite, nobody cares. Whereas the first time we get something on 3DS that's either exclusive to Japan or it's coming out months ahead of time, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of people that will be really almost probably competing to try and see if they can create some sort of region-free solution so that people can play it.
Well, I think ultimately Nintendo has little to gain from leaving their new systems region-free, and I think they have a lot to lose in the fight against piracy. You know, and unfortunately, the people who want to pirate really badly are probably going to find a way no matter what, and so it ends up punishing the rest of us, but the number of people who actually take advantage of the region-free capability in a legitimate way is so tiny that they really don't care if they piss us off. Or if they just disappoint us is probably a better way to put it. I mean, the fact that the Game Boy line of systems traditionally was region-free all the way up through DS and DS Lite, I think it really had to do with the fact that when Game Boy launched, there really wasn't an internet. There wasn't cheap shipping globally. There wasn't a way for people to even find out about the games in other regions, much less acquire them. And so they didn't really even think of it as an issue. And for whatever reason, maybe because of the architectural, you know, backwards compatibility and things like that, that carried through a few generations of hardware until people started to identify it with the entire franchise of systems. And maybe that's why it survived as long as it did. But at this point, I don't think Nintendo has any reason to leave 3DS region-free. They don't really care if it upsets us, because we're going to buy one anyway. This might even make us buy two.
I've got two Wiis. I'll remind you of that.
Yeah, their approach to region locking has become increasingly more sophisticated. And I mean, if you look at how the N64 was region locked, it was ridiculous.
Back then, all you needed was a converter cartridge.
Or a pair of tweezers to pull out the plastic.
Yeah, it was just on a physical level, basically, that you just needed to, like with the Super NES, the cartridges were just a different shape.
Right.
Between Japan and America, for instance. So they didn't really try that hard back then. You know, GameCube got region free really quickly. I mean, that was almost instant, I think, that you could get systems that were region free.
Well, the way GameCube was set up, it basically had a switchboard, a circuit, and if it was wired one way, it was Japanese. If it was wired another way, it was American. And so the first thing people did was wire it both ways and put in a switch. Bam, it works.
Yeah.
The PAL versions were different.
Yeah. And of course, that's something that handhelds have never had to deal with, is the different TV standards. So that was always one reason why the hardware could be pretty much the same everywhere. Right. And I mean, the one thing that was nice, I guess, is for people, if you're traveling with your handheld, you could just see a game in a store in another country, buy it and put it straight in and start playing it. I mean, that's nice for travelers. But again, as Caesar kind of points out in his letter, it's just not something that's going to really piss off like a huge swath of the population, the loss of that. So I don't think it's going to be region free, but I wouldn't completely rule out the idea of the homebrew community coming up with something, even if it takes a while. I mean, it took a while for the Wii. Yeah, relatively compared, so it could take a while, but they could come up with something.
And just to comment, the fact that it took them years to get the Ace Attorney games in Australia is ridiculous.
What the
hell is going on down there?
Yeah, my advice for Caesar is
move.
If you don't like the way Nintendo functions on Australia, don't give them your business. import from the US or Japan or Europe, where, you know, wherever you feel like is going to have the most games that you can play and want to play. I mean, honestly, you'll probably save money that way from what I hear about Australia.
I remember one of our forum posters commenting in one of my Infinite Space threads when I was just crying. It was basically that A, the game came out months later, and B, it was like the equivalent of $65 US.
For a portable game.
I paid $20 when it was new months earlier.
Don't support that.
Well, John, you have the next letter.
Sure. James, Tales of Fan, on our forums, in Virginia, writes, I just recently finished playing Kirby's Epic Yarn, and I loved it. However, I was a bit frustrated with its extra content. I had originally planned on finishing the game 100%. I even completed every level with a gold medal and acquired all the items. But when it came to the extra minigames, I just could not get into them. They feel like they were only added to the game to give it replay value without paying attention to whether or not they were fun to play. Why is it the video game companies feel that they need to give us extra content to lengthen the game, even if it adds no real value? It almost reminds me of filler and anime, another area where this gets on my nerves.
I think they just wanted to continue the Kirby tradition of inserting useless minigames.
In some cases, historically, those minigames have been amusing, like the quick draw game back from the NES game. But in most cases, they're just like, why am I doing this?
I think, well, on the broader topic, I mean, I think there's a lot of different reasons, obviously. You know, some of it is the way that games are reviewed. You know, among all the very complicated and sometimes sort of esoteric kind of things that are involved in evaluating a game, one of the most easy to hold on to is how much of there is it? How many hours would it take to play through? Mm-hmm. And so given that that is such a sort of salient metric in a review, very often games might think, you know, well, we want to actually put something in there that could at least bump that number up in a bunch of reviews and therefore make people think that it's more worth their money. What that then leads us on to is the fact that there is such rigid, even now, price structuring with games, with retail especially, you know, because every game is $50 on the Wii, you know, well, not every game, but, you know, very, very many games are $50 on the Wii and $60 on the other systems. You know, there's a lot of games that can't compete in terms of the amount of hours that you might get out of them with, you know, an RPG or an online shooter or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they feel the need to kind of pad it a little bit just so it doesn't seem as deficient compared to those experiences in terms of the amount of time that you're going to be playing them. That's why I think it is this kind of an affliction that you see in a lot of different games where, you know, it really isn't appropriate. And I think you would see it much less if it were just like more conventional to say, here's a new game. It's not a budget game. It's not an inferior product. It's just $40. That's just the right price for this kind of experience. But the problem is, at the minute, if you release something below the usual price, it's like saying it's a cheapy game, a lesser game.
Yeah, well, I see so many games. Like, I just think of God of War and their challenge rooms. Does anybody really play those challenge rooms in any God of War game? And it's just fluff. And I mean, like Greg said, I mean, you know, they're going to charge $60 for that game. So nowadays, you can't really charge $60 for a game and have it just be a single player game. And I mean, you've even seen that with games like, you know, like Metroid Prime 2. Really, there was no point in putting the multiplayer into that, but they had to do it because you can't just sell a game that's just a single player game these days, right? It has to have something extra.
Well, you could go to, you know, Uncharted 2, BioShock 2, Dead Space 2. Gotta have the multiplayer. What is that about? Is that because people are clamoring for multiplayer in those specific franchises? Maybe some people wanted it, but really it's probably because it offers the promise of playing it well beyond just a single player playthrough.
Yeah.
I will defend Metroid Prime 2 Echoes multiplayer because I think the nature of the Metroid franchise and the way that character works, there was an opportunity to create something unique in multiplayer. And I certainly think they probably did a better job of creating something unique than Hunters did on the DS, even though that was primarily a multiplayer experience. It was the same idea, it just felt tighter on the GameCube game. But, you know, I think that's a fun mode. It's not something I ever spent very much time into. And I guess my problem was that it didn't take enough advantage of what makes Metroid fun and try to convert that to multiplayer. But I like the idea of adding multiplayer to franchises that traditionally haven't had it if you think you can do it in a really weird, interesting way. Just like with Assassin's Creed, Brotherhood has just done that. Castlevania did it earlier this year with that Harmony of Despair or whatever. I wasn't interested in it, but I thought it was a neat idea. I just didn't really like the approach they took to it. But I'm supportive of experiments like that. And if you talk to Retro Studios, they'll tell you Echo's multiplayer was an experiment, and they would consider going back to it at some point. But, you know, that it wasn't very well received. It wasn't played very much, and that's why they didn't put it in Corruption, the third game. Yeah. But I don't really think they did it because of marketing pressure. I mean, Metroid Prime was a huge success. It sold a couple million copies. So I don't really think they felt a need to add multiplayer to it in order to keep up with the Joneses.
I would say that for all the praise that was lavished upon the original Metroid Prime, I can recall reading more than one review that says, well, because it hasn't got multiplayer or anything like that, you know, you're only going to play it for as long as it lasts. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm not saying that was influential on them necessarily, but that sentiment existed.
Yeah. Well, people who think that way are stupid, because that, I mean, Metroid Prime is longer than almost any first-person shooter I've ever played. So yeah. I really can't imagine anyone playing that game and thinking, I didn't really get my money's worth.
Well, a lot of people would say, you know, with the original Prime, far outside of extraneous multiplayer or whatever, that, you know, just the artifact thing and getting the 12 things to open up the final boss area was in itself an exercise in padding that perhaps didn't need to take place. But again, for some reason, they felt that they needed beefing up. I don't take such a dim view of that in Prime as I do, say, for instance, of the Triforce Hunt in Wind Waker.
It's
something, you know, I think this is something that, you know, is probably becoming more of a concern for people, for gamers as they get older, as they've got more pressure on their free time. They want less filler. It's not a question of, you know, saving up for a game for ages and then wanting that to last. You know, they've got more disposable income and less time. So they want the density of the experience to increase. And as I said, the problem with that is just that there's this other pressure in the opposite direction of, you know, trying to compete with other games that offer all these hours of experience and, you know, the way that reviews handle them. But I do think once we get down into digital distribution and price flexibility increases a lot more, you'll see less of this kind of stuff that James is talking about in Kirby.
I would love to be able to buy, like, say something like Uncharted 2 is a good example. I would love to be able to have a choice of, like, maybe I don't want to pay for the online component of it. Maybe I just want to buy the single-player component of it.
Yeah, I've never played that game online.
Nah, me neither.
It's really good. I was actually surprised. It's really, really well done.
It may be, but I don't know why it would be interesting. It just never compelled me to even try it.
It actually reminds me a lot of Modern Warfare.
So it reminds you of a lot of Modern Warfare in that you lose as soon as you start playing?
Well, I mean, you know, regardless of whether you're good at the game or not, it's really well done. It really is. But I'm not going to Uncharted 2 to play that game online like I would be for Modern Warfare 2. So it's irrelevant to me.
I think one thing we haven't addressed is that, you know, Kirby's Epic Yarn is a game by Goodfield. Their previous game was Wario Shake It, Wario Land. And that game also had all these treasures that you find all over the place, and they don't do anything. Greg has discussed this recently. I mean, you get them to get them. They don't do anything. And I wonder if maybe either reviewers or maybe just internal commentary from Nintendo, their publisher, was that, you know, if you're going to have people collect all this stuff, it should do something. And so they went into Kirby thinking, we need to give the players something they can do with all these treasures that they collect. And so they give you these apartments that you can furnish the way...
The decoration.
Yeah, you decorate them a certain way, and then that unlocks these mini-games. So I think maybe they were put in not as filler to extend it, but as rather a way to justify collecting all this stuff. I think it fails in that way too, but it may just be a different motivation behind it, you know.
I think that is a legitimate point, that because it is a bit of a problem if you're sort of trying to chain together all these incentives, you know, what you do one thing for another thing for another thing. At some point it's going to end. And here it kind of maybe ends on a bit of a limp kind of note with these extra mini games. All right, well, that is going to do it for listener mail this week. Thanks to everyone who sent their letters in. And we always need more, of course, so you can get those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And that is going to bring us to a close for this episode of RFN. Next week, Johnny is still going to be on the road, but he's going to be, in fact, in Boston. So he will be able to make an in-person appearance on the show with John Lindemann.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. What can we expect from this rare example of physicality on RFN, do you think, John?
Three words, my friend. Cho Aniki cosplay.
No. No.
Oh, that could make some excellent chapter art, I think.
I have two more words for you, John. Suddenly single.
So, there you go. That's a bit of suspense inserted into the show.
For the record, I think Johnny would look better with long hair. I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
I mean, the chemistry's always been there, even when you're separated.
What chemistry? Steroids?
Even when you're separated by thousands of miles.
It's going to be bromance. Bromance of the highest order.
It's going to be electric, I think.
I think it will be. There'll definitely be sparks flying.
I mean, you think about how homoerotic the episode with Lindy and Evan was back in the day. I mean, and they were, you know, all United States continental mass apart at the time. It's going to be exciting. Before we go, I should do what we usually do and promote the new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, featuring TYP and James Charlton, British man in Japan. Newscast has got part one of their Best of 2010 show, with part two forthcoming to look at as well. And of course, you can rate and review those podcasts on iTunes as well as ours, which I would be very grateful for. I noticed there was a very complimentary review recently by Kilimanjaro, who frequently writes emails and talk back stuff for us. So thanks for that. I only get to see the stuff that's on the European iTunes. So if you're wondering why I'm singling that one out, that's why. So that's going to do it. See you next time.
Later.
All right, well, we will now move on to the second letter, and James, you have this one.
Oh, okay. See you.
What is that noise?
What is that?
I'm sorry, I'm blowing my nose.
Okay, so because it's like really muffled, it's really difficult to know. It's like, is it an animal? Is it, yeah. Is it like cardboard being wrapped with a stick?
Sounds like a fan.
Go on, James.
Hold on, make a pose myself.
Yes.
You're gonna have to get over this.
I'm sorry.